Thank you. You may be seated. And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State versus Davis, but before we get to that, we will have introductions from the court. I'm Mike Havakin, the Chief Justice, and now by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves. I believe.
One second, just signed in.
Technical difficulties here, perhaps.
Judge Miller Lerman, can you hear me?
Judge Miller checking in.
Okay.
Now, by order of seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
I'm Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle, good morning.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Jeff Funk, good morning.
Jonathan Papik, good morning.
And John Friedenberg.
Thank you, members of the court. Counsel, as you can see, Justice Miller Lerman is on the WebEx. Everybody else is here in person. So we will proceed with State versus Davis. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Very good. We appreciate your wearing your masks when you are not presenting to the court. When you are presenting to the court, please remove your mask so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. With that, Mr. Breen, again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Judge Kelly Breen, Nebraska Commission on Public Advocacy, on behalf of Raymond Davis, the appellant. Mr. Davis was convicted of first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit robbery, and use of a weapon after a jury trial in Sarpy County District Court. The appellant has assigned three errors. I will address them in the order that they are in the brief. First, dealing with an issue of the prosecutor's impeachment of his own witness during her testimony. It was the prosecutor's desire to show to the jury that the defendant had a consciousness of guilt and lie, and that led him to lie about the time of his departure from the Omaha Bellevue area till his arrival at this witness's residence in Des Moines, and also about the place of his departure, whether it was from the Omaha Bellevue area where the substantial portions of the crime were alleged to have been committed, and the city of Council Bluffs, which the defendant from time to time resided in. This witness, Julie Skalberg, was the subject of a motion in limine, not upon the testimony that she offered at trial, but upon certain salacious facts that she had indicated in a statement to the police, which was unrecorded and was taken down by note by an investigating officer. The other significance of the testimony to the state was appellant's lack of emotion and apparent lack of fear, because a part of his defense was he was unaware of the conspiracy to commit a home invasion, that he was there for the purposes of security for an act of prostitution by a co-defendant, Alicia Cook, and arranged for by her boyfriend, her erstwhile pimp, who had come up with the idea of robbing John's. And Alicia had amended that plan to make it robbing them in their homes so they could get more than their wallets, they could get their property.
Mr. Breen, I had a hard time trying to figure out what the prosecutor was trying to do with this witness and why the prosecutor even called this witness. And I'm not sure what the significance of your assignment of error is. How would the case change if we were to side with you?
Well, Judge, I think it's in a kind of a reflection of the defense. We had another witness, Crystal Martin, and her testimony, the state wanted to vigorously attack and say that she was biased toward the defendant. And when this witness went south on the prosecution, didn't state what the prosecution believed she should have testified to, which was the substance of her of a police report, he just went after her. I mean, he brought this witness to tears. And I think the significance of it was, is that the prosecution was allowed to abuse this witness in the face of the jury and thereby denigrate the defendant's defense in this matter.
You're not contending that a prosecutor is never allowed to attack the credibility of its own witness, are you?
No, I think the controlling law is State versus Dominguez, and it's very clear that the prosecutor can impeach a witness, but it has to be crucial to his case to allow him to do this to a witness and to get before the jury unsworn testimony.
Assume you're right that this evidence shouldn't have come in. How is this not harmless error? What's the significance of it to the verdict?
Well, I guess first, what
did the jury hear that they shouldn't have heard, and why does it matter?
What the jury heard was that the defendant lacked emotion and fear, which undercut his defense that he had fled, and that was the state was going to use that as an argument of consciousness of guilt, and had stated that in their opening statement. And it was crucial to the defendant's case, and he had substantial corroborating evidence of it. Alicia Cook and Chris Reagan employed other people, their compatriots, in a 2-day search for Crystal Martin and my client, Raymond Davis. And the purpose was to silence him by any means. This was a chase was undertaken that covered blocks and blocks of Bellevue and Omaha in their attempt to get control of both of these people who could testify against them. And that was a crux of our defense. And what the state was saying was, my client wasn't in fear of these people, but my client wasn't emotional about leaving and had lied about where he'd left from in an attempt to cover up the crime. All these things being consciousness of guilt. And in light of what the defense was, and in light of the cruciality of our explanation of his leaving the Bellevue, Omaha area, it was very, very damaging to that case.
Is there any dispute that he came from the Omaha area to Des Moines?
There is no dispute that he came to Des Moines and that he left Des Moines, was the location of Ms. Skalberg. And there's actually a trip that they take back to Council Bluffs because Skalberg wants to acquire some methamphetamine. No, there's no dispute. They left the Omaha Bellevue area. The home invasion homicide occurred in Bellevue, but most of the alleged defendants were associated with Robert Carlson, whose house was in Omaha. So it is a crime that was committed between those two jurisdictions, but I don't think my client was under any obligation to tell anybody where he'd come from or where he'd gone. And the actual sworn testimony of this witness is she just assumed he came from Council Bluffs because that was the connection she had with him, living in Council Bluffs. And she wasn't sure that she didn't believe, she said she thought she assumed that, but testified that no, she couldn't recall either one of those people, my client or Crystal Martin, telling her that.
Didn't the jury hear that, though?
The jury heard that, but then.
He said, he may have said things were getting crazy. And so I came here. And she says, I don't really know for sure where you came from.
And the jury heard that, but the jury then heard that she had told a police officer something different.
That things were getting crazy in Council Bluffs.
Yeah.
But is that the same as I came from Council Bluffs? That I left Council Bluffs and went to Boyne? Is that the same?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's the same. But the fact of the matter is that statement to the police officer wasn't sworn testimony. And the state, in the end, didn't want to elicit any sworn testimony from this witness. It wanted to get the police, the statement that she reportedly made to the police, an unrecorded statement was drafted from the notes of an officer. And there's a party cannot impeach his or her own witness without limitation. The rule permitting a party to impeach his or own witness may not be used as an artifice by which inadmissible matter may be gotten to the jury through the device of offering a witness whose testimony is or should be known to be adverse in order under the name of impeachment to get before the jury for its consideration a favorable ex parte statement the witness had made. And that's from State versus Dominguez, 290 Nebraska at 489.
Did the appellant take the opportunity during cross to set up these facts for the jury? Which one was accurate and which one wasn't?
By the time the state was done with its direct examination of that witness, she could barely testify. I think the evidence was in the case. She's addicted to methamphetamine. And having been brought there as the state's witness, she was sworn and she testified, and her testimony was attacked by the prosecutor. I did not feel I would get any advantage in this case by reaffirming what her sworn testimony was by discussing the impeachment material that the state used against their own witness. I agree with Judge Heavykin. In the large scheme of things, of this witness's testimony was not wholly determinative of the case. She wasn't an eyewitness to anything. She only saw these people 2 days after the alleged, well, the actual home invasion of Brett Quigley's house. But her testimony was significant because the state wanted to undercut the defendant's theory of the case and wanted to undercut an essential matter to that defense, the fact that co-defendants believed that he was going to drop a dime on him. And that was important because that's what happened. This individual went to Brent Quigley's house, not as part of a conspiracy. And we argue that as our third assigned error. The evidence upon that's solely the testimony of Alicia Cook.
With respect to that third assignment error.
Yes.
Is the argument that we cannot consider anything Alicia Cook testified to?
Judge, you can't reweigh the evidence reweigh the evidence here on appeal, and I recognize that. But and, you know, it's emblazoned in wood above you. Eyes and ears are poor witness when the soul is barbarous. Alicia Cook was barbarous.
Okay, I understand that, but my question is, are you arguing we cannot consider her testimony in weighing the sufficiency of the evidence?
You can consider her testimony in weighing the sufficiency of the evidence.
And if we consider her testimony, do you still have an argument that the evidence is insufficient? I mean, doesn't she testify? I know you disagree with it, but doesn't she testify that this is a...
Well, the test is, if you take Skalberg's testimony out, is there sufficient evidence to support the conviction? And I suggest to you, because of the cruciality of the defendant's theory of the case being attacked by the state in this manner, that we can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that it did not affect the jury's deliberation, and that whether the jury gave fair deliberation to the issue of the defendant's theory, that being his flight didn't evidence guilt, and that these people sought to silence him from speaking with authorities.
What about Ms. Cook's testimony? I mean, doesn't Alicia Cook testify about a conspiracy to rob Mr. Quigley that eventually results in him being killed? And if we take that testimony and we view it in the light most favorable to the state, isn't there sufficient evidence?
Well, if we view it in the light most favorable to the state, do we still ignore the fact that Alicia Cook lied and tried to pin this crime on Raymond Davis by saying their boyfriend wasn't even inside the house when Brent Quigley was killed?
We don't get to judge credibility, though, do we? We're not there.
No, but you don't have to judge credibility to know that a witness lied. And you don't need to judge credibility to know that a witness perjured herself in deposition testimony. You don't need to reweigh the evidence to see how Alicia Cook's story evolved.
Are all those
through her interaction?
I beg your pardon. I do have a question.
The artifacts that were pointed out to the jury, and we pointed out to the jury that she got a recommendation for a sentence of 20 years on this.
Judge Miller-Lerman is attempting that.
Oh, yes, I beg your pardon. I do have a question, since we're talking about the conspiracy. If any, did you want to address the adequacy of the charging document with respect to conspiracy?
Judge, I do, and we assign that as an error. I'd cite to you, and I know it's an unpublished opinion, State versus McKay at 2 Nebraska Court of Appeals 276, but I'd also cite to you the Nebraska Revised Statutes, section 29-2014, which states no conviction for conspiracy shall be had unless one or more of the overt acts be expressly alleged in the indictment. The state's kind of got a tautology going here. If you say that someone's involved in and charge someone with conspiracy to commit robbery, and you say the overt act was robbery, you've satisfied those requirements. And that is a tautology.
What do you think would be a model complaint in this case?
Well, overt acts actually don't even have to be crimes. They just have to be something that was done that was in furtherance of the conspiracy. But the charging document, the indictment, what the statute says, you got to expressly state what the overt act was. And saying generally,
in your opinion, what would that be in this case?
In this case, it could be a variety of things. Phone calls, Facebook messages, acts of individuals transporting people. Pardon?
Those should be listed in the pleadings.
They have to be alleged expressly in the indictment. Conspiracy is different than any other crime. And the charging document has to inform the individual of the specific acts, particularly since they aren't crime, they don't have to be crimes.
Excuse me, I beg your pardon yet again, so the question becomes, I beg your pardon yet again, that the question here is, the charging document says something like that count three robbery, quote, did commit an overt act to wit robbery in pursuance. So that's the tautology to which you refer. It could have said exchanged messages or drove to the Quigley House or any garden variety event, correct?
That's the crux of our argument, Judge.
Thank you.
For there to be a conspiracy, obviously, it has to be more than one person. Agreed?
Agreed.
So in that situation, why is it not the actual commission of the robbery involving more than one person a sufficient overt act that can be proven?
Well, an overt act is different than a crime.
I agree with that. I don't disagree with that, but I'm
not saying that an overt act has to be a crime. It was very important in this case, because there was no evidence that my client handled the murder weapon, exerted any force against Brent Quigley, restrained Brent Quigley, or did any act which you could say he put this person in fear so they would give up their property.
Is there DNA evidence?
There is DNA evidence that shows minute, almost microscopic portions of blood about the lower pant legs of clothes that were found that were my client's clothes.
Mr. Quigley's DNA on Mr.
Quigley's DNA on his pants.
On Mr. Davis's pants.
Mr. Davis's pants. There is a clear substance that was taken from the knife handle. Wasn't blood. They don't know.
What does that show?
It shows that the knife handle DNA evidence shows all three people having touched that knife.
Including Mr. Davis?
Including Mr. Davis, including Alicia Cook, and including Chris Reagan.
So under your theory of the case, going back to the conspiracy issue, was he was at the location, the reason why this would not be sufficient for robbery to be the overt act is because he basically was surprised he found himself in the middle of a robbery.
No. Well, that's a defense theory, but what we're saying is the charging document didn't inform us of any overt act. To say you conspired to commit, it's like the case of McKay. In McKay, the charging document said the individual was charged with possession of marijuana with the intent to manufacture or deliver. And the charging document said the person committed the conspiracy to do that drug crime, and that the overt act was him being in possession of drugs to manufacture or sell. The state that the conspiracy to commit robbery is supported by the fact that a robbery was committed does not inform the defendant of the acts he has allegedly done that were in furtherance of the conspiracy. And we're just reading the language of the statute out if we're saying that that would be a sufficient charging document. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Breen, very much.
Nate, would you turn up that TV a little bit?
Mr. Lewis, good morning to you. Hey, proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This is Mr. Davis's direct appeal of his convictions of first degree murder, conspiracy to commit robbery, and use of a weapon to commit a felony. Mr. Davis assigns three errors. He alleges that the trial court abuses discretion by allowing the state to impeach its own witness, that the information charging him with conspiracy to commit robbery was not sufficiently specific, and a blanket sufficiency argument. The first, if there's no desire to take this in any particular order, I'll just handle it chronologically as presented in the briefs. The state's impeachment of Julie Skullberg was allowable under the rules of evidence and the law. District court's overruling of Davis's objections to the impeachment was not an abuse of discretion. The credibility of a witness may be attacked by any party, including the party that called the witness. Dominguez, I think, is the case that's cited in both briefs, as well as State versus Marco, 27607 says the exact same thing. That is not with impunity. The state can't use that ability to impeach its own witness in order to bring in testimony that would otherwise be unallowable. Mr. Davis claims that the testimony at issue was essentially not relevant and thus not good ground for the state to impeach its own witness. Obviously, the state did and does disagree. In those prior interviews, Ms. Skullberg told police that Davis arrived at her house. He told her either directly or obliquely that he had been in the Omaha Council Bluffs area, that he showed little to no emotion and came with his own backpack, which is implied to be the same backpack which was later seized by police in Missouri and found to contain bloodstained items in it, along with papers that had Mr. Davis's name on them, implying that they were his. DNA on some of the clothes that were inside of that backpack also had Mr. Davis's DNA on them, and that she gave Mr. Davis food. On the stand, Julie Skullberg provided different accounts, stating that she didn't know exactly where he was coming from, only that he spoke about the Council Bluffs area generally, that he was emotional, and that she gave him the backpack or somehow provided him with the backpack. Given the evidence presented by the state that Davis earlier participated in the assault and robbery of Mr. Quigley that led to his death before arriving at Skullberg's residence in the days preceding, these questions involving Davis's conduct, his motivations, his belongings, the things that he's carrying, the actions in the aftermath of the assault, robbery, and Mr. Quigley's death, the state feels are hardly inconsequential. I don't think that it goes, you know, any more, I don't think that it's any more complicated necessarily than just showing what Mr. Davis was doing in the days afterwards, what his actions were, what he had on him at the time, and how he sort of spent his days after the crime was committed.
What difference does it make if he came from Omaha or Bellevue or Council Bluffs?
Well,
I think difference does that make to the case? And if this were error, why would this, as Justice Papik asked, why would this not be harmless error?
I would agree that it would be a harmless error, probably at best. I think that the testimony about where he's coming from just further firms up that he's coming from that area. He didn't tell her, oh, I came from the Great Lakes to go fishing or something like that. He's coming from the Omaha area. He says something along the lines of, and it's getting crazy in the Council Bluffs area. He seems to imply that he's trying to get away from there and he's trying to put some distance between him and the Omaha area in general. I think that it just sort of firms up his desire to put distance between himself and the area, and the implication is that he is putting some distance between himself and potentially the crime. And as the record bears out, he's later arrested in the St. Louis area, so he is, you know, moving even further away. And I think there's testimony by Julie Skullberg or one of the other witnesses that says that he is telling people that he is going to go to Chicago eventually with Crystal Martin. While certain questions resulting in impeachment might not have been the most consequential, the content of Skullberg's testimony overall dealt with several consequential and relevant things. The state made clear from the beginning that when it started the impeachment, that it was doing it for the purposes of credibility. And I think that the record bears out that the state is not from jump trying to get combative with the witness so that it can start bringing in this.
Remind me again how this starts. She testifies what, that he didn't say where he was coming from, and then the state says, well, what about your statement? You said he was coming from Council Bluffs. Is that how this all started?
Right. Yeah. The state says something along the lines of, did he say where he was coming from? And she says, no, he didn't tell me exactly where he was coming from. And so the state then goes into, you provided in a statement, you know, to police that he said that things in the Council Bluffs area were getting crazy. And she responds that, yeah, he didn't tell me exactly. He didn't say, I am coming from, and I took this highway and I left at this time. You know, she doesn't get into the actual specifics of, you know, where he came from, you know, but.
So was she even demonstrated to have made an inconsistent statement, or was there just some misunderstanding that eventually gets clarified?
It might've been a misunderstanding. I think that the state was perhaps looking for an answer that was consistent with the statement that she gave police in the police report, And she gave a different statement, or one that denied any sort of knowledge about locations, geographic locations that Mr. Davis was talking about. So it might have been a little aggressive, I guess, but I don't think that it was completely outside the. I think, given her prior statements to police, it would not be unforeseen that that is where the state is going, and that's where they're coming from, and that's what they're talking about.
Did the prosecutor properly handle this allegedly inconsistent statement?
I think so. I mean,
refreshing of the mind and things of that nature.
Yes, yeah, and there's the refreshing of the mind with the police report, and then there's several other inconsistent statements after that, and that's where it starts getting a little bit more combative. So you have, it's not just the location statement, but it's also the statements about what you provided to Mr. Davis when he arrived at your house, what he had with him, what was his state of mind. This is, you know, several pages of testimony. This isn't just, where did he say he was coming from? I don't know. And then it launched into a tirade.
And then the court sustained several objections. Is that right?
Yes.
And then there's an offer of proof.
There is an offer of proof once the jury is left and the state lays out exactly what the police reports would have shown. And that's what was known to have been said by Julie Skullberg before.
So what do you think the jury actually heard?
The jury heard that she had made some statements prior about where Mr. Davis had spoken about geographically in relation to where he had perhaps been before. And then also that he had a backpack with him, and there's a dispute as to where that backpack came from. But other than that, there's nothing beyond that. Next, the state submits that the information filed against Davis was not defective. An information first question on appeal must be held sufficient unless it is so defective that by no construction can it be said to charge the offense for which the accused was convicted. That's State versus Thiessen. This court explained in that case that the expressed overt act in furtherance of conspiracy cannot be the act of conspiring. I think that was a clarification in the McKay case that the appellant cites, in this court said that instead of proper information charging conspiracy should indicate the offense, which is the object of the conspiracy, and expressly allege an overt act in furtherance thereof. That the information in this case mirrored that of the conspiracy statute is a similar circumstance that this court looked at in Thiessen and found helpful there. Much like the conspiracy statute, the information in this case pretty much mirrors the language that is contained within the statute. It's not conspiracy to committed an act of conspiracy in furtherance of a conspiracy. It's committed a robbery in furtherance of a conspiracy that was discussed with the other co-defendants.
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm not sure I kept up with that. So is the state's position that to properly plead a robbery or a conspiracy to commit a robbery, it is proper to say the object is a robbery and the overt act in furtherance of the robbery is the robbery? I think they need to be a little different, don't they?
I think that there are instances where that could be the case. I think that if you have conspiracy to commit robbery and there is not a robbery that ends up eventually happening, you can't have a robbery as an overt act where there is no robbery, but you can have a conspiracy to commit robbery. In this case, you had an actual robbery. You had, and you have witnesses and you have facts that show that not only did they go there to commit a robbery, but they actually robbed him afterwards.
But I beg your pardon, but the overt act is requirement is for a purpose other than describing the ultimate objective, right? It's to describe how this thing got built up, resulting in a robbery. We drove there, we bought a gun, we did text messages, and then we pulled it off. So in what way does this information satisfy the requirement that the overt act and its consummation be different?
I think that it could be different in, it certainly could have been more specific, and it could have provided a list of the things that they did in order to get themselves, or even just one or two things that they did to get themselves to the point of robbery. And I think that it could perhaps, you could look at it as there's sort of capital R robbery, you know, the felony offense, and there's sort of lowercase robbery, you know, the act of, you know, robbing someone. And I think that it could be read that the sort of lowercase r robbery was the overt act for the purposes of conspiracy to commit robbery, as opposed to, and I think that there was an additional charge for felony robbery that was contained within the information.
So what you would say is if the information says we did some robbing and reaching in his pants and grabbing her pocketbook and all that kind of stuff, those things, and it was ultimately the felony of robbery.
Yes. Yeah. They could have, in the information, they could have said something about robbing Quigley in pursuance of the conspiracy. I think that probably would have been a little bit more to the point of the.
But they did not. So given the language of the information, if we were to find that it isn't adequate, what recommendation would you have for the court?
I'm not sure what the remedy to that would be at that point. Yeah, I couldn't speculate, I guess, as to what the proper remedy would be to correct that, other than.
Well, would the state perhaps have to list every overt act?
Yeah, I mean, outside of this case, how that would, the ramifications of that for future cases, yes, I think that if I were, you know, prosecuting a case and I was charging something, I would provide then a very extensive list of overt acts just to make sure that I've got my bases covered.
Why couldn't the actual commission of the robbery be an overt act? I mean, an overt act can be steps short of the actual robbery, but why couldn't the actual robbery also be an overt act?
Well, and that's sort of, I guess my point is that I do think that the actual robbery is an overt act that can lead you to the act.
I thought I might have heard you backing away from that.
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that at least, I think that ultimately, yes, I think that the crime of robbery provided in the information is sufficient. But if you wanted to get more nuanced and talk about something short of the actual crime of robbery, the definitional crime of robbery, you know, sort of robbery in general as an overt act, I think that that would also be sufficient.
But the objective of having them be different, if that be the law, is to bolster a fact of conspiring. What little things did they do when they were conspiring prior to the crime? They talked, they sent messages, they went to the gun store together, they drove there together. It's to inform the progress of the case, right? It's to inform us about this didn't magically appear. There were some overt acts of getting together before the crime.
Most definitely. And in this case specifically, there are several of those overt acts that could have, you know, admittedly could have been contained within the information. I think that once you get to the point where the robbery has been completed, you know, that sort of umbrellas all that, you know, planning and all those overt acts together and bundles them together in such a way that perhaps listing out all those things isn't absolutely necessary. Whereas if you have a plan to commit a robbery that is not then completed, then maybe you would need to go into, you know, far more specifics. I think that if you don't actually have a robbery in this case and you have just a bunch of people sitting in a van, you know, brandishing knives and pipes and, you know, walking up to the guy's house and then deciding that we're going to turn around and we're going to go home. Yeah, you're going to need more than robbery because you don't have a robbery at that point.
Right. But we're not in the pigeonhole of an inchoate crime. We actually have a robbery. That is the allegation of the state.
Yes.
Thank you.
Point of clarification, and I apologize that I don't know this detail. Was this also charged as a felony murder?
It was charged as a first degree murder, and there was language about the felony murder provision within first degree murder statute. The jury was also instructed on felony murder as a way to find guilt in this crime. So there are felony murder elements to this case, and that is argued in the state's next point on the sufficiency arguments too. Now, if there are no further questions on the information part, I can move on to the sufficiency part. Finally, the state disagrees with Davis's contention that there was not sufficient evidence to support his convictions on all three counts. Davis largely takes issue with Cook's credibility as a witness. Cook's testimony directly places Davis at the scene and participating in the robbery, and credibility is a matter for the finder of fact, as was covered earlier. That aside, Cook's testimony was not the only testimony and evidence supplied by the state. The state produced at trial testimony from law enforcement officers, investigators, analysts, as well as other experts and witnesses. There were text messages, Facebook messages, DNA reports, cell phone data, explanatory reports of that cell phone data, autopsy reports, and photographs. The evidence established the trio's movements and locations around town, their presence at the residence in the vicinity when a neighbor heard, neighbor across the street from Mr. Quigley heard yelling, and their vehicle was seen at Quigley's house by a Ring doorbell system. The presence of Quigley's possessions at Carlson's house was also covered, where the group had stayed and socialized. Disputes about how the stolen goods would be divided, the recovery of items likely used in the assault and murder of Mr. Quigley, the presence of blood and DNA on Davis's clothing when he was arrested in Missouri, which did not exculpate his participation in the killing, and then also testimony about the medical cause of Mr. Quigley's death. The evidence in total showed that Davis participated in the killing of Quigley while attempting to rob him, participated in an overt act in furtherance of a conspiracy to rob Mr. Quigley by planning to rob him, breaking into his house, fatally assaulting him, and eventually robbing him, and using an object in the assault capable of killing him, as evidenced by his death, and then also the finding of DNA on several objects throughout the pendency of the investigation. As argued by Mr. Davis, I don't think that Reagan or Davis's intent to kill is material under the first degree murder statute and the provision allowing for felony murder to provide culpability for a finding of guilt for first degree murder, which is codified in the statute charged against Davis and which the jury was also instructed upon. If there are no further questions, the state would submit on those points and those contained in its brief. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments in State versus Davis. The court will go, counsel, you are excused. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Side versus Side.